Welcome to this week's Rock and Talk with Jim Perry. One of the area's greatest musicians tells his stories, a life of music.
I'm going to tell you where everything began. The reason why I took off on this crazy life of music. And it all started really when I was very, very young. I was 4 years old and my mother was already expressing the interest in having me take piano lessons. She tried to get both of my older brothers to learn how to play piano, but they were both abject failures. And my mother was, she was determined to get music in the family in some way or another.
Did she play? Or?
She didn't really play. She just loved music and she sang. Yeah. She ended up singing for 40 years in the chorus at church.
Nice.
She was very God-fearing Catholic woman. It was probably right after I turned five that she found a piano teacher for me right down the street. At the time, we lived up at the top of Copperfield Road in Tatnick Square, and she found a piano teacher with walking distance, so that was pretty cool. Mm. And I took lessons from her for 3 years. Her name was Mrs. Malo. I took to it right away, and my mom was like, wow.
Thrilled, I bet, yeah.
Yeah. After I finished piano lessons, then I got organ lessons because my parents bought a Hammond organ for the house. It was pretty cool.
Just for you?
Yeah.
Just because. You're the only one doing it.
Well, my mother was so excited that there was actually the opportunity for live music. That's why it showed up. There it was in the middle of my living room, a Hammond L100 console organ. So I started taking lessons from this guy, Oliver Edmonds, and he had an accent, and he was a funny guy. He would smoke cigars and make the house smell awful. But his big thing was he would count off songs, and he would go like this. All right, we play song now. 1, 2, 3.
No matter what the timing was?
Well, if it was 4, he'd go 1, 2, 3, 4. But that was Oliver Edmonds. I only took lessons from him for a year and a half. It didn't seem like it was a great match. I think my mom didn't like the cigar smoke. Mm-hmm. And then I started taking organ lessons from a woman named Ann Lind. And it was a perfect match. Took lessons from her for 5 years. So I took organ lessons for 7 years.
Wow.
After taking piano lessons for 2 years.
Yeah.
Okay, so this time, well, in the middle of still taking organ lessons, a lot of things happened in the world, you know. My mom took me 4 or 5 times to see The Sound of Music, and I was like, this is what I want to do. I want to write these songs. I really became enamored with songwriting first.
Wow. Huh.
And it was Rodgers and Hammerstein. And then The Young Rascals came out, and that was really before the big impact of the Beatles. It was The Young Rascals.
Yeah.
And of course, they had a big Hammond organ on the cover of their first album. That helped. I loved The Young Rascals, and that was my introduction to modern music because I grew up with what my parents grew up with big band stuff and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Felix Cavalieri became my first hero, music hero. Hmm. The way he played the organ in The Rascals was like, I want to do that. Great. My mother got me to be on
community auditions.
Community auditions.
Yeah.
So she got me to be one of the
really
performers.
What year was this?
At the auditorium. And this, I have a picture of it somewhere.
Oh, you have to find that.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
What year was that? I'd say maybe I was probably 9 or 10, so 63, 64.
Wow. How'd you do?
I did pretty good. You want to know what I played?
Yeah.
I played a medley of songs from My Fair Lady.
Oh, my God. Did you sing, too? Or?
No.
Oh.
But it was like, I'm getting married in the morning. This is what I grew up with, you know?
Yeah.
We had a Leave It to Beaver family. Then, not long after that, the Beatles came. But I didn't get, I wasn't like most of the people who, on the night they were on the Ed Sullivan, their whole lives completely changed.
Right.
For me, it was more like a slow leak.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And then at some point, I looked back at the beginnings of the Beatles after about a year, and I realized that's it.
Yeah.
I wanted to play guitar. My new hero is George Harrison, and so I don't know how this happened, Gail, but when I got the guitar, I didn't have to take any lessons. I just kind of knew,
really,
what to find and where to find it, and it came from what I learned on the keyboards.
Wow.
And I just started playing. I just learned all the open chords that I heard in their songs.
Yeah.
And I started being able to tell what the little licks were and everything. And
wow, because nobody does a cover like you do. You are kind of a genius in my mind, because to be able to pull it off, to have it sound, yeah, okay. So you just...
Thanks. Thank yeah. you. I can just hear everything that's going on. And I can picture it in my mind's eye.
Hmm.
So then I can translate it to the other band members. This is what he's doing. No, no, not over there, over there. You know, so it's a Jeez. Gift I'm eternally grateful for.
Yeah.
So that was, my early teens. I got caught up in the same thing that everybody around the country did, you know, bands in garages. Kids with their first guitars and first drum sets, and it was an unbelievable time to be that age. I mean, how perfect was it to be the age we were at? Because that was, and it was all because of the Beatles. It was like overnight, Mom, I have to have a guitar. Mom, I have to have a microphone. Mom, I have to have some drums. You know, every kid in the whole country was Beatle mad.
Wow.
They opened up this whole Pandora's box of you can do it yourself.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need a songwriter. You don't need a professional this or professional that. You can do it yourself.
Yep.
It was a monster they created. So inevitably, there were groups of kids in my neighborhood that would get together and want to be the next Beatles. And there was a friend of mine, three houses up from me. His name was Pete Stalalonis. And for years, we used to get together, and both Red Sox fans, and we used to get together in his backyard and pretend we were the Red Sox, okay? So it was all, you know, and there was no ball or anything. And we'd use a stick for a bat, and it was just all in our minds.
Yeah.
And we'd be the announcer. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to Fenway Park. Number 8, Carl Yastrzemski, you know, and all this stuff. And as soon as the Beatles came out, we became the Beatles on Ed Sullivan.
Oh, my God. There was like no more baseball.
No more baseball. It was, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Beatles. You know, and it was that from that point on, a real reflection of the sharp turn my life took.
Yeah.
Just through my playful characters with Pete.
Yeah.
I haven't seen him since then. So
maybe he's listening right now.
I wonder if he's listening. You know, I got into various bands. We'd play in the den room of somebody's house down the street, and then I'd get together with somebody in their garage, and it was just getting a feel for things. In the meantime, I kept begging my mother for the newest album that came out. You know, a couple of the first ones I got was the first Monkees album, the Mamas and the Papas, the Turtles. I just couldn't get enough. Beggar.
Yeah.
And, you know, she was like, oh, all right. So I started collecting a little record collection. And I would listen to the record and stare at the cover. Stare at it. And read the liner notes. And I just got into the habit of loving to do that.
Mm.
So when we finally got a band started, I sat down with a sketch pad and designed the cover.
Oh, wow.
So I started
a different style of artistic.
Oh God, it was like, it was just because I wanted it so bad. I wanted to handle every aspect of it, I guess.
Yeah.
Not a control freak kind of thing, but just, I can do this.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Just eagerness. And I would come up with the band names, and some of them were just horrible, but I thought they were great, you know. One was The Objective Past. What the hell does that mean?
I don't know.
It just sounded cool to me.
It sounds kind of cool now, though. I don't know.
I've heard worse.
Yeah, yeah.
Another one, which we settled on for a little while, was Warmth.
I don't know.
It was kind of neat for, you know, those psychedelic puffy letters.
Yeah,
and stuff.
Yeah. Warmth, yeah.
So, you know, that's just a couple of little vignettes about what kind of mischief I was getting into at that age.
Yeah.
And I still had no idea where it was going. All I knew was I was going to be a rock star. So then I met a couple of guys that we were a little more serious than the ones before. And it was Billy McGilvery and his brother Peter. They lived in a nice big house on May Street in Worcester.
Yep.
Still the same neighborhood, the Tatnik area.
Yep.
And they had a basement, a big finished basement, and there was a section of the basement where they had their musical equipment, and they already had stuff.
Mm.
Billy had a drum kit. Pete had his guitar amp and guitar, and we made friends with one of their neighbors, Don Marks, and then this kid Chuck Rafelson sang a little bit, and it was...
So you're getting more serious. This was going to be a band.
Yes.
All right.
Yes, and the McGilvery's, they were a little different from all these other people that I met because they were deep into music. They really understood a lot of the nuances that the other kids didn't. The other kids, it was just, give me my drumsticks and let's have
fun,
whatever.
Yeah.
But they got it. So we got serious. We had some gigs here and there at churches and at friends' houses and stuff like that. First time I really had a taste of being in a serious band. Now, I have to stick this in right now. I'm in two bands right now with Bill.
Oh, wow. And how many years later is this?
Don't ask. It's 53 years later.
Wow. That's awesome.
Or so, yeah.
All right. So we'll hear more about this serious band in the next episode then, I guess, right?
Absolutely.
All right. Jim, thanks for coming back for the second episode. And last week we heard about the start of a more serious band with the McGilvery brothers. And what happened then, after that?
Well, thank you for having me, and this is great.
Well, I love it.
I'm going to continue talking about the McGilvery brothers just for a minute here before we move on.
Yeah.
Bill is still in my life in a big way because he's kind of gained a reputation as one of the best drummers around, and he's so busy, and the fact that he takes time to play with me is really an honor to me, but this is back then.
Yeah.
That's now. What happened with the McGilvery brothers was we rehearsed probably more than we gigged, you know. It was just, we loved playing, and we would learn these songs. Just a good example of a song that we had so much fun playing was Time Is Tight, and it was an instrumental by Booker T and the MGs. And it was so fun playing it because they all knew the parts exactly right, and we would play it, and it would just feel like we were listening to the record, but it was us playing it. Well, I remember, you know, they had a huge record collection down there, and I remember some of the big records of the time were like Soft Parade by the Doors, Cream Did Israeli Gears, Jimi Hendrix was huge. Anyway, their basement became my second home, you know. My parents would have to beg me to come back home for dinner. It was great. My relationship with the McGilvery's was very, very special. Their mother had two grand pianos. She had these, she was a pretty accomplished pianist.
Wow.
And so I would go up there every once in a while and just play the grand piano and just like feel, like I was on top of the world.
Did you ever play with her? Did you guys do
No,
Caribbean?
She was strictly classical.
Oh, okay.
But strictly that's, classical.
Oh, that's cool.
But she treated us really nicely, so it was like a second home.
Mm.
And that lasted a few years. Hmm. And it was kind of just drifting because I was going to school at the same time, and so were they, and part-time thing.
Yeah.
When we were done with our homework, if we ever did it.
Back to the music.
You know, during the time that I was playing with the McGilvery Brothers, I would say the age at the time was probably between 16 and 18, maybe 15 and 18. And during that time, I was interested in finding out what other bands were in the area. This is where things started to get kind of serious. You know, some local bands would make recordings and send them to WORC, and WORC would play them, and so you'd get to hear Worcester bands on the radio, and it became this thing that was growing and getting exciting. And it was the same thing that was happening all over the country. Local bands were saving up their pennies, going into studios, recording a two-sided 45 record, and they would spend hours practicing those two songs, and a lot of them were original. Some of them were good. Some of them were not so good, but it was still part of the same scene. And WORC was very supportive. One of those bands was the Joneses. Okay. The Joneses started really making some hay because they were really good. And so I went to see them once down at what is now the seafood restaurant on Highland Street.
Oh, sole proprietor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I forgot what it was back then, but they had live bands.
Yeah.
And they would play, afternoon shows. And so I went to see them. I was completely blown away. They were my new heroes. They were like, oh, my God. And the bass player, Marty, he looked like, a Greek god or something. And was like, this is insane. And then the D'Angelo Brothers with their long, long, wavy.
Oh, I've seen pictures of those two. Holy mackerel.
Yeah.
I've seen those.
And their manager was Fred, their father.
Yeah.
I remember watching them, and they did a song called Daddy Rock and Roll, which the D'Angelo Brothers wrote about their father.
Oh.
And I'm like, this is crazy. This is so good. I want to do this. And I got almost desperate. For some reason, at some point, Marty decided to leave the band. And I'm not sure why. I know he ended up living down in Texas. He's still down there. So anyway, back to the Joneses. What happened was I was 16. And I was so excited. And I knew that I could play the music. Mm. And so I came up with this crazy idea of joining them. At least auditioning for them,
yeah.
And so I did, and I did pretty good, and it looked like I might be able to join the group, but they were really concerned about how young I was.
And this was on bass or?
Bass,
yeah.
Okay. Yes. And,
wow.
And so I had to go home and talk to my parents, and I'll never forget this night because they heard my story, and of course I was pleading and begging it the whole time because it was, oh, Mom, that's what I want. And so they said, we'll give you an answer later this evening. And so I remember how.
Awaiting?
In my room. And it felt like I was waiting for a verdict of guilty or not guilty on a murder charge.
Death sentence or not.
That kind of stress,
Wow.
And finally they came up and said, we can't do this. You're just too young. And of course they were right.
Oh, really? No, I was all hoping you were going to get the gig.
So that was, my first brush with, I can do this and I can do it on a higher level. Mm. I just knew it.
Yeah.
And I wasn't a real cocky, confident kid.
Mm.
I just knew that.
Yeah.
I just knew that. I was shy in other ways, but give me some music to play.
Yeah, you have the musical chops.
I was hungry.
Yep.
And I was probably the middle of 17. So around this time, I met Cliff Goodwin in a classroom at Daugherty High.
Oh, God.
It was like, it was sophomore year. And so I met Cliff. He's this guy sitting in the study hall, and he's got straight hair parted in the middle. It was down past his nipples.
Really?
Yeah, it was really long.
And that age, I mean, it's not that wasn't normal.
It was starting to be, you know. Yeah, a lot of the new bands that were coming out, their hair was long. You know, we're talking about, I mean, even after Cream and Jimi Hendrix, you know, it wasn't as innocent as it was at first. And the Beatles' hair had gotten longer, and the Stones and everything. So Cliff had that look, and he looked totally like a rock star.
Yeah.
Sitting there in this classroom in junior, you know, in high school. And
well, even now with the white puff of...
Well, that's my point, is that he had it figured out immediately. But he was really an engaging personality, and we had a lot of music stories to share.
Yeah.
And he was the proprietor of a record store on Highland Street. I can't remember the name of the store, but I would go in there, and we would listen to new records, you know, because they would come in and he would be behind the counter and he'd go, "Jim, listen to this song by this so-and-so."
Oh, wow.
And I remember listening to, you know, like a band like Nas, the record would come in and he'd go, "There's this guy, Todd Rundgren, and we need to hear him play guitar." And, you know, and I shared all this stuff with Cliff. It was fantastic. Cliff, once I got to know him, somehow he knew the guys in this band called Lord Byron's Creation. That was the name of the band that the Martin Brothers, I'll get to them later with Albatross, the Martin Brothers, yeah. Mike Lynch, they were all in this band, Lord Byron's Creation. Meanwhile, Cliff was in a group called Appleton's Journal. Somehow Cliff knew Mike and the Martin Brothers, or saw them or something, and him and I had been talking, and he said, "You should go see these guys." And it was one of those outdoor park concerts. Mm-hmm. And I remember walking up beside the stage, and I remember the first song I heard them doing was Celebrate by Three Dog Night, and the harmonies were unbelievable, and I'm like, wow. Then the second song I heard them do was How Many More Times by Led Zeppelin, and it wasn't Mike singing, it was Jerry Martin. And he was hitting all those high notes. And I'm like, this band's got so much talent. Paul was behind the drum smacking away. Paul is Jerry's brother. So he had Paul and Jerry Martin and Mike Lynch, plus a few of the other band members. But those were the guys I was focused on. And that begins the story of Albatross.
All right. We'll hear about that next week. Thanks, Jim, for coming in again.
You are welcome. So, you know, after seeing Sound of Music 5 or 6 times, and other musicals, I mean, you know, but also all the show tunes that I was playing on the organ, it really exposed me to a lot of songwriting. And I think that's also where I got my ears too, because I just would be fascinated by how it would get from part A to part B and all this stuff. Where I was living, still living with my parents up on Copperfield Road in Tannock Square, I was making some friends on the next street over. Among those friends, I met this woman, or girl at the time, who was visiting from New Jersey. She had a friend who lived on the street next to mine, and his name was Jonathan Zacks, and her name was Sherry Weinstein. We got to be really good friends, and you could just tell the way that we talked with each other, that there was a connection, an artistic connection, that went way beyond just being friends.
And what age is this? This is younger?
We were 13.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I mean, you know, but we were thinking about stuff that most 13-year-olds didn't. Mm. Ken Sutkus started joining us at some of these gatherings. His passion was poetry. His heroes were, without a doubt, Bob Dylan and Paul Simon. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't really into that scene musically very much until I met him. Mm-hmm. And then he started turning me on to the possibilities of lyrics. Almost immediately, he started giving me lyrics. He would give me a handful of lyrics that he wrote. And he would start writing his poetry more in the style, in the meter style of songs, because he knew I was interested in it. So we kind of like were trying out each other to see if we could become a songwriting team.
Oh, wow.
Meanwhile, Sherry also wrote lyrics. Her connection to me at the start was more spiritual. She was just a real supporter of what I could do, and it was an interesting relationship. And with Kenny, it was pure, we can do this together. Mm. He was the lyricist, I was the musician. Wow. I mean, I've got probably 300, 400 songs that him and I have written. You know, I have the lyrics all in a file on my computer. They're not all recorded, obviously, but I can remember how maybe 80% of them go. Yeah. You know, and there might be some lost songs in there that, oh God, I remember writing that, but I have no idea how it goes anymore.
Wow, and how many of these did you record? Because I know you've had a long career of,
yeah,
you know, or do with bands. I mean, did a lot of these make...
Initially, none of them were recorded professionally, you know, but I would always have some kind of cheesy little tape recorder and just set up a little microphone and play a bunch of the songs on some out-of-tune piano in a back room or whatever. And so I have a lot of those tapes that have survived. Songwriting was really almost more of a passion than, you know, playing guitar and being a rock star. Hmm. Songwriting has always been essential to what interests me. Ken lit the fire.
Yeah.
Lit the fire completely.
Now we're going to hear from Jim about the beginnings of the band Albatross with Cliff Goodwin and Mike Lynch.
Cliff arranged it so that we all got together. And so we got together and we talked. And I don't remember a lot of details about this. I wish I remembered more. Maybe Cliff does. Maybe Mike does, you know. Mm-hmm. But I do know that we were just discussing music in general. And they were looking for a new group of people to play with. Cliff had recommended me on bass. Okay, so it was bass guitar that I was basically going to be in this band. But there was only one problem. I didn't have a bass. I was a very naive young kid at this point. And the only thing that got me into the inner circle of all these, you know, people who were serious about their future in music was my ears. I could hear everything. I could, you know, and they knew that. You know, I could play things pretty quickly. I knew a lot of good rock guitar techniques. And so I had the goods. But mentally, I was still just a kid, you know, and I didn't have a lot of responsible thoughts about pulling my rock star act together, you know. So I didn't have a bass. But I remember one other thing about that first sort of audition day that we had, and it was one of the dumbest things I've ever said in my life. But it was, you know, reflective of what I was into at the time. This was 1968. Chicago Transit Authority album first came out. I still wasn't into a lot of rock and roll. I was still under the influence of what I grew up with, and it was like music that was real music. You know, I had no idea who Bob Dylan was or the Velvet Underground or anything like that. So that came later with my education by Mike Lynch. That's a whole other story. Meanwhile, I said to the other guys in the band at this audition, if we do any Chicago songs, I'd like to sing them. And they all looked at me like, what the hell are you talking about? It was just a very dumb thing for me to say. Uh-oh. Of course, I've been reminded of it many times. It was out of character because, yeah, you know, yeah. I think that there was an atmosphere around the band that we wanted to rock. You know, that
no,
it was
Chicago wasn't a rock.
Chicago, well, you know, right from the beginning, Mike was really into the difference between music that was too white, you know, which soulless, and music that really meant something. He was the king of that. I mean, he made sure. We sort of trotted on, pulled together rehearsals, and then we started rehearsing regularly in the basement of the Martin Brothers. They lived on Ripley Street down in Maine, South Worcester. Big, gigantic old house. And we rehearsed in the basement, and I'll never forget those days. It was really special because, you know, we had a turntable down there, and every time a new album came out, we'd listen to it together. Mm-hmm. And just the way that all those people thought. Around this time, we also included into the band John Bianchi on keyboards. Okay, who was, an absolute lunatic, brilliant lunatic kind of guy.
Yeah.
But he was also an amazing organist. I mean, he would do things that would blow your mind. And he would play so hard sometimes his fingers would bleed.
Wow.
I mean, he was a force of nature.
And now this is the beginning of Albatross.
It's the beginning of Albatross. Yeah.
The new band out.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
And then at some point, you know, there was talk that it would be great to have double guitar parts. Oh, I'm getting ahead of myself. The reason we started talking about that is because Cliff left. You know, and Jerry was the only guitar player left.
Yeah.
Cliff left because he, you know, I guess he had a different vision for himself than we had. And so then he ended up forming the American Standard Band off of that.
And now you guys were writing songs too, Albatross? Or?
Oh, yes, we were.
Okay, all right.
And it was mostly Jerry Martin, okay? Jerry Martin wrote some unbelievable songs. And it got everybody so excited.
Are there recordings of these?
Yes.
All right.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well,
yeah,
hey,
you'll hear this, yeah.
Okay.
There's really good recordings of them too.
Yeah.
Jerry just had this gift. He was like the Paul McCartney of Worcester. I hate to put it that way because it sounds so presumptuous.
Wow.
But he knew how to write beautiful melodies. It wasn't Mike's cup of tea, and Mike was the one singing all this stuff.
Mm.
And that was sort of the beginning of this sort of dichotomy of Albatross. And Mike was just doing his duty, singing these songs, because, you know, that's what he knew. But if you sat him down and said, "You must love these songs," he'd probably say, "Not really," because he wanted to sing stuff like Dylan. His idols were, you know, stuff that was raw, the Stooges, stuff like that, you know. It was an interesting combination. Mm. Because, you know, Jerry was Mr. Melody. Well, I kept telling them I could play guitar. I could play guitar. Maybe we can find a bass player. Then eventually I kind of convinced them that if we want to continue the two guitar sound, I could be the second guitar player, and it would be easier to find a bass player. Enter Bobby Palermo. Cliff's time with Albatross was very short, but he was instrumental, definitely, in getting us going
mm-hmm.
and giving us a serious outlook, and then he went his own way. So the way it evolved was Bobby started coming to rehearsals. He was good. He was a fun guy to be around. It was very important for us to, you know, to be compatriots together. Then we started getting really serious, arranging some really wild original material. It was really serious at that point on.
And where were you gigging? Were you guys, like, doing college things?
Yeah, we were doing a lot of fraternities,
mm-hmm.
a lot of beer-soaked fraternity parties, you know. And it got so good that, you know, we started developing a reputation. And then management came in, and they got real serious.
Oh, geez. That sounds kind of scary.
Well, it was great, but it also wasn't. So that's going to be really the essence of the next part of the story. So, once we got together and we had our rehearsals in the basement of the Martin house, Jerry and Paul lived down in Main South on Ripley Street in Worcester, and it was one of those big, almost castle-like old homes, drafty and all kinds of stuff, and we practiced in the little basement down there. And we started pulling together stuff, and Jerry was writing songs like a maniac. It just came to him as natural as, you know, throwing a baseball to some teenage kid or whatever. He just, boom, started writing amazing songs. And at the same time, there was almost like this push-pull dichotomy in the band between the Mike Lynch camp and the Jerry Martin camp. Mike Lynch camp being, let's listen to the rawest stuff we can, rock and roll, you know, feel, everything is just feel. So he would be listening to Bob Dylan and Lou Reed and David Bowie and stuff that in the gut. Meanwhile, the Jerry Martin camp, I shouldn't narrow it down to just Jerry, because we all kind of love this stuff too, but it was all that California sound. I mean, Crosby, Stills, and Nash was huge for us. James Taylor. So there was a, sort of this quieter, more melodic side. Of course, we were all Beatlemaniacs and Stones freaks, but that's almost a different category. I guess what I'm trying to say is that's where the original song list came from, those kind of influences. We would learn stuff that was like, for example, we learned All the Way from Memphis by Martha Hoople. That became one of our really big opening numbers. That was all Mike, really. I was really green when I joined the band, and Mike taught me so much about what was really out there, because I grew up in a Sound of Music family, you know. So it was an eye-opener for me. Anyway, we just started playing out, mostly at fraternities at Worcester Tech. It was kind of wild. We made some friends over at a couple of the frats. One of them turned out to be an investor in the band later on. We'll talk about him later. But it was just the very beginnings of creating some kind of vibe with the band. And it was all the Tech students and the Becker students. And of course, it was, you know, men at Tech and women at Becker. And so we got the best of both worlds, because, you know, the woman really loved, and generally speaking, really loved the quieter stuff. And we ended up, three of us, Mike, Paul, and myself, imitating Crosby, Stills, and Nash and playing at the Becker Coffee House. And we really learned a lot there about each other and how to harmonize and all that kind of stuff. But meanwhile, we were rocking the house down in beer-soaked fraternity parties. I mean, sloshing through the beer, I'm telling you. Dangerous times. But we really... I dare risk this, but I guess when the Beatles played it in Germany, you know, they, anything went, and they just kind of learned so much about each other. Disclaimer, I am not comparing us to the Beatles, but it's just that whole experience thing of set up and do whatever you want, and we learned so much from that. While we were there, we met a lot of intriguing people, including this gentleman named George Cook. His wife, she ran the Garden of Delights. They both had an apartment just off of West Street, around the corner. And George was a wannabe entrepreneur. You know, he really saw something in the band. He was really originally from Macon, Georgia. And he was a little older than us. I think he's like 81 now. So, and he's still living out in California. He was the first person to create a situation which felt like it was going to end up being a management team, because he took such interest in us, and he listened to our music, made suggestions. It never became official management contract, but he was always around. He befriended us. We'd go up to his apartment and have quote-unquote meetings. You know, and it was interesting. He was a character, a very, very nice man, and he would have these things that he would say that were very Macon, Georgia. Pouring down rain, I'll never forget that one. Over at Worcester Tech, we met a gentleman named Bruce Amdur, A-M-D-U-R, who eventually became our booking agent and the second of three partners in the management deal. But this is pre-management. I'm just mentioning that this is where they met us. Mm. Meanwhile, a year or two went by before it became serious about turning it into management. And we kept doing these gigs. George and Bruce got it to the point where we were doing a lot more gigs at places other than Tech, you know. Mm. And it organically started turning into a team and something that was... something to get excited about. Yeah. And a lot of it revolved around Jerry's songs. He was so mature at the time musically that it was scary. We developed really fast because we were still 17, 18 years old. When we started, I must have been 15. Then we developed and we did some really wild cover songs, and people started coming to see us over and over again. Yeah. So we developed the following. That was through 71 I'm 72. One of the gigs that we did, it was actually booked for us by another guy who somehow ended up on the scene from Northern Connecticut, Rod Dumas, and he ended up booking us in Hartford, opening for Chuck Berry and Tom Rush.
Wow.
Strange billing. The concert, Chuck Berry, and it was in 1972. Okay, so I was 18.
Wow.
The whole band was pretty much 18. I think Jerry might have been 19. And so we show up at the place. I remember snippets because, you know, I mean, because there's just so much going on in my life at the time. And you can't absorb everything because I was nervous about the show. I was, you know, there's so many things to think about at once. But I do remember being backstage and finding out as we were getting ready to do our sound check that we weren't going to do our show. Our particular set was canceled out. That's also when we found out that we were going to be Chuck Berry's backup band. Hours before the show.
Oh, my God.
Now, there's some listeners out there listening to your show that know about Chuck Berry and about his shenanigans when he went out on tour.
Oh, really?
He would do this every...
He didn't bring a band.
He didn't bring a band.
He just shows up.
Yeah, he would just show up.
Doesn't warn you.
But we had no idea.
Wow.
So there was panic. And then it was...
rightfully so.
Then I had to be the one to listen and call out whatever key we were in or whatever, because I can hear it. There was one moment where we really wanted to talk to Chuck just to find out what the set was, any signals that he wanted to give or anything like that. We found out that his dressing room, quote unquote, was a beer closet, you know, and he was in there. So he's knocking on the door. Excuse me, Mr. Berry. No response. You know, after a couple of times banging, what do you want? You know, he just... And all I remember from that is he ended up opening up the door in a huff and kind of looking down at us. He was tall, I think maybe 6'3 or something.
Wow.
He was tall. Hi, Mr. Berry. I guess we're your band, and we just wanted to know if there was any, you know, and he was really impatient. He just said, look. And this is classic stuff, absolutely classic. He says, whenever I go like this, and he bangs his foot down, boom. It means stop. Whenever I go like this again, boom. It means start up again. That's all he's got to know. And then he slammed the door shut.
Wow.
That's Chuck Berry.
Wow.
That's Chuck Berry, the king of rock and roll. A complete, I can't use these words.
Yeah.
On the radio, but you know what I mean. I did hear a story years ago about how Bruce Springsteen was in a band where the same thing happened. It was before the E Street Band.
Yeah.
You know, and so it, you know, happened to everybody on all levels.
So how'd it go?
It went unbelievable. It
really?
Was so great. It was sold out. He was doing the tour to support his only number one song, which is laughable. Because his only number one song was My Ding-a-ling.
Oh, God.
When I was a little bitty boy, my grandmother bought me a cute little toy. Silver bells hanging on a string. She told me it was my ding-a-ling-a-ling. Oh,
ding-a-ling! My ding-a-ling!
But he was mega popular.
Yeah.
It was a huge comeback thing for him. So it was a great show. We did great, you know. A lot of his songs start the same way. So I'd watch the guitar while he was doing that, and then I'd have to yell to everybody.
Yeah, what key it's in.
What key it's in.
Yeah.
And we survived.
And if the foot came down, stop. And then if the foot comes down,
actually, that didn't add up to anything. It was just him being a blank blank. There was one song near the end of the show where it was a slow blues, and he gave me this snide look just before the middle of the song. And he looked at the audience, and he looked at me, and he went, let's let this guy's, you know.
Oh, he pointed to you, like to solo?
Like do a solo,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, wow.
I did a really, really good solo.
Okay.
Because I wanted to stick it up his, you know. And he kept it. He was such a a teaser, toying with his band like a little mouse. During the solo, he would look at the audience with this look of astonishment on his face, which was, you know, sarcastic. And then he looked over at me, and then he'd look at the audience, and the audience would applaud and all this stuff. I'll never forget that moment, because here I was right in the middle of a performance by the king of rock and roll, and he was toying with me.
Wow.
It was unbelievable. That show was one of the greatest nights of my life and one of the worst. But it really was one of the greatest. That's a good example of the quality of gigs that we were starting to get. Mm. So there was a lot of vibe out there for the band. So it started becoming this thing, you know, the same way that Zonkeraz was with their crowd. We became one of the bands, you know, the Joneses and all those bands. And it just kind of started happening. And then, okay, so this is where it was decided that we should live together.
Tune in next week for Rock and Talk with Jim Perry when Albatross moves in together. Oh, my goodness. That sounds like trouble.
So, you know, here we are, a young band, a very immature band, but a really talented band, an unusual band, because we didn't really fit into any, you know, cliches of different types of bands at that time. We weren't a jam band. We weren't a rock band in the traditional sense of the word. We weren't an arena band. You know, we just didn't. It was hard to pigeonhole us.
And you were doing coffee houses, too. You said you were doing harmonies.
Yeah.
That's totally different than a Chuck Berry gig.
And that was just the beginning of our experimentation. So I'll tell you. Yeah. Well, we'll get to that. So here we are. Ideas are coming from all over the place. I mean, we would get together to play, and it would just go in all these different directions. Everybody was throwing out ideas faster than, you know, people could absorb them. Mike Lynch was particularly wild in his concepts. He just, you know, no holds barred, you know. He was a big fan of that whole, well, that hadn't happened yet, but it was almost as if he was part of that Max's Kansas City, CBGB's New York thing where, you know, anything went, even stuff that was shocking, you know. Mm. So you had that on one end, and on the other end, Jerry Martin was writing these exquisite pop songs. Some of them that just didn't fit in with the kind of band we were, but we didn't care because they were great.
Yeah.
Jerry was really turning us into the band with potential because of his songs. But it was weird because Mike sang them all, and he really didn't like them that much.
Hmm.
But we all knew that this was a ball that kept rolling, and we had our role to play, and we didn't have a chance to stop and think, is this really what I want to do? You know, each of us as individuals, it just became this thing.
A machine.
A machine. That is correct. And the machine decided we should live together.
Oh, no.
Which, that really was the point of no return. Because once we decided to do that, it was a commitment. It was a complete commitment to our lives.
So how many of you live together? The whole band?
Yes, the whole band, but not the management.
Okay.
Which became a contentious point later on because we were making really good money and they were taking salaries.
Hmm.
And we were getting per diem.
Hmm.
I don't think they were ever trying to legitimately screw us. But if you really look at it closely, I don't know. It was odd because we had to answer to them. The money all went through them, and we got a certain stipend, and nothing beyond it.
Hmm.
It was very strange. But anyway, that was behind the scenes. First house was in Shrewsbury. It was right on the corner of Route 9 and Route 140. It was a yellow house that had been not abandoned, but, you know, nobody was living in it, and it was, you know, locked. And so we rented it. I don't know any of the behind the scenes of that because I was too busy being a drug-taking, beer-drinking teenage musician.
Yeah, yeah. And how old are you now? Like 18, 19? I mean,
18, I think.
Yeah, jeez.
There's some pictures from inside the house, but they were mainly just band shots, you know, not, you know, walking through the kitchen while someone was in their underwear taking pictures.
Oh, damn.
Damn. Sorry to let you down there. But we, you know, we took some official band pictures, and anyway, it was extremely bohemian. I mean, it was really bohemian. There was a front porch, and we sat out there pretending we were Crosby, Stills, and Nash from the cover of their first album, and yeah. It was the same kind of porch. Jerry was on an absolute tear songwriting. And so while we were, wow, we all live together, let's have another joint and all that stuff. And I mean, we were just crazed kids.
Yep.
Jerry would just lock himself away and write and come up with songs. He'd come out and say, I got a new song, and listen to it. And he'd play it, and we'd go, what is that?
Wow.
You know, he wrote this song called A Thousand Universes. A lot of his songs were just beautiful McCartney-ish type love songs.
Mm.
With melodies that you just could never forget. And we're going, and that's when I started thinking crazy stuff like, we have our own Paul McCartney. Maybe we can be the next Beatles, you know. Couple of years, I was in dreamland. I did not have my feet on the ground, and yet the band was evolving into something different. We were becoming harder rock band. Mike was a commanding presence on stage.
Mm.
Jerry quit.
Oh, geez.
He quit not long after we got that house. He had enough.
He actually ended up really quitting when we first met the two gentlemen from out in Los Angeles that were brought to meet us by our management. They got excited by what, you know, the recordings that we did that they heard. And Jerry met them and he saw right through them. And of course, the rest of us were fawning. They're from LA. They think we're the next Beatles. And I mean, it was like, it was insane talk. It really was. And they were also both cokeheads. So there was that new thing introduced to us. Meanwhile, we're living together. Jerry bails. And he had a, you know, he had a girlfriend who was, you know, basically his childhood sweetheart, and they're still together, you know. And so he went and chose a normal life. But the management, the two guys from L.A., this is where the machine started to take over everything. Because we wanted to, well, okay, Jerry's not here. I write, you know, Paul was writing great stuff, our drummer. He even wrote the first single, Passport to Pleasure. You know, so he was a really good writer. And so we thought, let's see what we can do. And the management had meetings and they said, we're here because of Jerry's songs. You guys going to have to keep playing them. We became the vehicle for his songs. And we would still write our own songs and, you know, get them in there somehow or another. Paul was emerging as a really, really good songwriter. I'd throw a gem in every once in a while. But it was all about Jerry's songs. And that started the whole dichotomy tension. And the management didn't care. And they spent most of their time in L.A. anyway. So they'd have phone calls with local management, and it was all messed up. But we kept plowing away because it was a machine. So we would keep recording the songs, rearranging them so that it was more like us and less like Jerry. It was insane. So around that time, you know, that house that we were living in Shrewsbury was a couple of steps away from being, you know, condemned, basically. It was, you know, not a very nice house. And somehow, I don't even know how we got this, but I think it was through George or one of our managers or something that we found a beautiful house in Northboro that was not being occupied. Today, it's the Westboro Savings Bank. So it was a beautiful old building right on Route 20 on the corner of some street there. I can't remember. But it's right near the center of Northboro. Right next to it was a gas station and a family named the Pierces, who also owned other property in Northboro. They were like, you know, big family in town. They owned that bank building too. It wasn't a bank building at the time, but
I can't wait to go buy that. I'll be like, that's the house that Albatross lived in.
You'll go, are you kidding me? They let them live there? There was probably 6 or 7 bedrooms. You know, and 3 bathrooms, and it was a 3-floor home, you know, and the top floor, the ceilings were a little lower, and it was one of those kind of houses, and we all had our own rooms. It was insane. It was insane, you know, talk about debauchery. We got things done, you know, we weren't complete lunatics, just partial. You know, Mike was really into pot at the time. We had this centrally located living room where the stereo was. And he would sit in this big comfortable chair. And I'll never forget this. I mean, to me, this was like going to rock and roll class for me to listen to the stuff he was listening to. But the way he listened to it, he'd get stiff stoned to the point where he would just stare at the wall. With his arms on the armrests of the chair and just stare at the speakers and listen. It was incredible. And he would listen to, you know, Martha Hoople, Lou Reed, Iggy and the Stooges, and all this stuff I had never really heard before. And I'm loving it. I'm going, wow, what the hell is this? So that was Mike. Everybody else was, you know, they had their own lives, but we had schedules too. You know, our management was like, we're going to rehearse every day, you know, maybe 9 in the morning or something, or 10. It was run like a business. And we had a recording set up in the living room, and then there was a line of power up to the second floor, I think, and that's where the board was and the recording equipment. The musical equipment was on the first floor. And so, you know, we set it up.
Wow.
We set it up so that we'd get work done. And our whole efforts while we were there, too much of our efforts was taking Jerry's songs and making them more accessible to our people, and more mashing up with the new stuff we were writing. So it was like, why are we doing this? There'd be times where we would say, why are we doing this? And Mike was going out of his mind. He didn't want to sing those songs,
yeah.
You know, and we're doing them 50 times a week. It was a grind. And it almost drove Mike crazy. Mm. I know that. I could see it. He was on his way out. But somehow, you know, he stayed with the band up until the very end, even after I left. We'll get to that a little later.
And how long did you live together then? In the you think it was a couple of years?
Yes. Although I quit while they were living there. I quit in 79. I think we lived in the house for maybe 4 years.
Wow. That's a long time for debauchery.
Well, we paid the Pierces. We were never late, as far as I know. And we got to be friends with the son of the actual owner of the buildings. But the son, he was this brusque-looking, bearded grease monkey who, was in charge of the gas station. I remember at the time the song Golden Years by David Bowie had come out. And we called him Junior Pierce, but we also called him Junior Fierce because he would pretend that he was really tough, but he was. So we'd sing it, Junior Fierce, what?
I hope he's listening right now.
Hi, Junior. No, we got along good, but we did some crazy things. I remember coming home from a gig, and you know we'd be so wound up and excited and all, you know. I would do this thing where I'd say, let me out. And we'd be about a block from the house. And what we would do is I'd get out of the car and they would chase me with the car.
Oh, my God.
So it was pure debauchery. just a small example.
Thanks for tuning in this week. And that song we heard was Together Part 2, a great example of Jerry Martin's songwriting capabilities and the band Albatross at their finest.
During the course of these few years in the middle of the 70s where we were playing everywhere and Jerry had left and we had started with the management and blah, 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 the machine was rolling. We had already recorded in a local studio. The recordings came out pretty good. I still love to listen to them. But the two guys from California, they wanted a professional producer to record some of our songs out there. So some money was raised. One of the partners of our management was actually a money person. He was from Rhode Island, and his name was Ken Droicor, Droitcour. And came from a wealthy family. He forwarded us quite a bit of the money. And then we also got some help from somebody who became a dear friend of ours. He was in one of the fraternities over at Worcester Tech. We met him there. His name is Adam Taylor. He's still out there. He's still out in California, and he's a really good guy. His family had money. He was from New York City. His family owned a famous apothecary on Lexington Avenue, and they had customers come in like, you know, Jackie Onassis and,
wow,
and people like that. So, he was from, you know, higher up. So we pooled together money. We flew to Santa Monica. The plan was to stay there for, I think, 2 weeks. And we ended up staying at the producer's house. I can't even remember his name. He was a African-American gentleman. But I think he had a little bit of, like, you know, Haitian or something in him. He was light-skinned African-American, but he was recording us. We stayed at a hotel in Santa Monica. In between recording time, we'd swim people's pools, and we did get to go to a few parties, including one at the home of Buddy Miles.
Wow.
And while we were at his party, we met Roger McGuinn.
Wow.
And, you know, that was a little bit of temptation to us, like, well, we can be like them, you know. By the time we were done, I couldn't wait to get home because I didn't really like the people out there.
Yeah.
It was really, you know, usually when you meet people, it's, how are you?
Yeah.
No, there it's more like, hey, what are you into?
Yeah.
You know, everybody's got a thing that they're after, yeah. You know. And when they meet somebody else, the first thing they want to find out is, can this person do something for me?
Yeah.
And you could just feel it. You just feel it. And by the time we left, I couldn't wait to get home. And it turns out that the trip really was wasted because the recording that we made didn't have the same magic as the stuff we did back home. That was a learning experience, big time learning experience.
You know, we get back from Santa Monica, we get back from California, and we got all kinds of stars in our eyes. It was really, we were very, very naive now that I look back at it. And I think I was probably more naive than the other guys. I just was so, oh my God, I'm going to be a rock and roll star. You know, you don't think about the gory details until it's too late. But in any case, at that time, we were flying high. We were a little confused about the fact that the trip to California was, it felt empty after we were done. We had recorded the two songs that were going to be our single, okay? Let me tell you a little bit about those two songs. First of all, Passport to Pleasure, which was written by Paul Martin, our drummer, who was all, you know, he also played some guitar, obviously, because that song was written on guitar. First song he ever wrote, which is insane, because it is an unbelievable rock riff, rock song. This song, Passport to Pleasure, written by Paul Martin. As I said, it's the first song he ever wrote. And here's a song that, you know, over the years, people pop out of nowhere and talk about how much, oh, Passport to Pleasure, I used to have that single, that was fantastic, or, you know, whatever. People just never forgot it. Including, and this was a recent development, just a couple months ago, actually, and this was out of the blue, but it was fun to listen to. Nuno Bettencourt from the band Extreme, who are basically reuniting for a tour or something like that, you know, so they got some action happening. Nuno was recently interviewed on one of Rick Beato's YouTube videos. And, you know, Rick Beato, anybody who's interested in videos about music and guitar playing knows who Rick Beato is. He's kind of like a big star in the YouTube circuit. So there's Nuno Bettencourt doing a two-hour interview with him, somewhere about an hour and 20 minutes in, for any of you who want to go check. Rick asks him, you know, when he first started getting interested in music. And it had been established that he was from outside of Framingham. I forgot the name of the town right now, but, you know, Milford or something like that. So he was talking about one day when he was walking downtown to meet up with some friends, and he went by the high school, and the doors were open, and it was a Sunday, I think, so it was like some kind of matinee thing. And it was us playing inside. And we were doing a sound check, and we were sound checking with Passport to Pleasure. And he's telling Rick Beato this story, and he's all enthusiastic. He's leaning on his knees, and he's leaning forward. I couldn't believe the sound that was coming out of these doors. And it was like, and then then all of a sudden he goes, and the song, it was called Passport to Pleasure, and he starts humming the riff. And Beato's looking at him, you know, and I'm looking at this, and I'm going, are you kidding me? And so he talked about how that moment, he came in, too, and when we took a break, he bought the single because we had it on display, you know, like most wannabe bands did back then. So he bought the single, and he said, I played it almost every effing day for the next couple of weeks. And he was so enthusiastic. And then Rick Beato turns to the camera, and he goes, thank you, Albatross. And I'm sitting there going, okay, welcome.
That's awesome. What a story.
Yeah.
And for that to be so many years later, to be talked about on a show like that, wow.
Yes, and that was the power of Passport to Pleasure. You know, it was a great riff. It really was. Still is. I can still listen to it and not feel like it's, you know, impossibly dated. It's cool.
Here's Passport to Pleasure by Albatross.
Burning in my brains, yearning for another night alone with you. Now talk song, keep it coming to me all night long. The good or bad or right or wrong, keep cool. I tell you, baby, what I'm gonna do. Don't need no diamonds, baby. Don't need no treasure. I'll be your passport to pleasure. I'll give you more than no man can measure.
And then the flip side, which I wrote, and it has, you know, it's about as far from Passport to Pleasure as you can get. It was a reggae-infused song, and it was called I Believe in the USA, which, you know, was all about having options that you might not have in other parts of the world. And I don't know if I'm listening to myself say that now, and I'm kind of laughing that the United States is not really fulfilling my dream in that song. But it was, you know, it was just a fun song. And it was, keep in mind, it was 1976, so it was the 200th anniversary of the country. Yeah. And so I was thinking, you know, maybe we can get this hooked up to be a theme.
Mm.
Yeah, but unfortunately that didn't work out, that part of it. But it was blatantly commercial. And it was good. You know, both sides were really good. Our two managers from the West Coast that I had mentioned before, Lou and Toby, were very excited about the songs. And I had also mentioned before that they were obsessed with keeping Paul's brother Jerry's songs in our playlist. And they were starting to get excited about the fact that we could do it on our own. But it was still insistent that we keep all of Jerry's songs. I'll get into that a little bit later, too.